From WHQR Public Media, this is The Newsroom. I'm Ben Schachman. Thanks for joining us. On today's show, we're sitting down with Jason Smith, District Attorney for Pender and New Hanover Counties. A year ago, Smith won a contentious race to replace Ben David, who had served as DA for 20 years. Smith had big shoes to fill, but also serious challenges: restoring morale, implementing eCourts, a new statewide digital court management system, and dealing with new state and local legislation, including IRENA's law, a criminal justice reform bill inspired by the murder of Irina Zarutska in Charlotte, and Wilmington's new anti-camping ordinance. And there's the persistent and thorny issue of youth violence, a deeply complex and difficult issue that Smith has made his mission to take on. All right, District Attorney Jason Smith, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you again for having me.
So it has been just about a year since the 2024 election.
Right.
There was a lot on your docket, stuff that you wanted to try and tackle, things you were concerned about, things you were looking forward to. Mm-hmm. And I appreciate you coming in for this opportunity to kind of work through some of that.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, look, when we were running for DA back in 24, and you talk to people and they were like, oh, you've got big shoes to fill, or you've got, you know, Ben David was in for 20 years. What are you going to do different? Or is it going to collapse on you? And we talked, you and I spoke even during that. We had some goals. Some of them I expressed to you. Some of them, really, when we got in, we changed some of our goals or made new ones. And I wanted to go over some of the goals that we had for 25, how we met those goals or didn't meet those goals, and then some of our goals for 26. So the big one, I would say, was stabilize the office. You saw the campaign last year, and it got ugly, and we had openings even back then. It wasn't campaign related. We always have openings. I say always. We don't right now, but we always have people come and go. So it was stabilize the office. I campaigned on leadership and experience, and one of those was how to manage an office. And that's one of my first goals was, all right, let's stabilize the office. Let's look and see what we have asset-wise, people, and set some, are they where they're supposed to be or where they need to be to grow? And that's kind of my first goal, was stabilize the office and then assess who was there and what their strengths and weaknesses and where were they better served. So, and we did that. Right now we have zero openings. That means zero attorneys and zero legal assistants. And we've had Connie Jordan retired earlier this year, but we had a plan how we were going to replace at least her position. It's hard to replace a Connie Jordan, right?
Yes.
That's almost an impossible task, but we did, in fact, fill that position, and we had a plan for it. So when I first got sworn in back in December of 2024, I came from Pender. I spent 10 years in Pender. So we were missing that kind of that lead person up in Pender, and I did make a hire for that. Shirley Schmierczyk is up there. She is rocking and rolling. She has really set the trail blazing up there with trying cases, handling cases, and there's a three-person team up there, and they're really doing a good job.
If I can ask a little bit of a follow-up here.
Right.
One part of this that I think it would be helpful maybe to get your perspective on, mm-hmm, is that this is, in one sense, a political office. You're
right.
Republican.
Right.
Ben David was a Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
But it's almost like the political laws of physics aren't quite the same in the district attorney's office as it might be in, say, you know, if city council were to completely flip from Republican to Democrat, mm-hmm, you might see some leadership change. I mean, it just works a little bit differently. Can you
sure,
shed some light
sure,
on that
sure.
phenomenon?
Look, you saw, yes, we have to run. It's a political position. You have to run. You have to run by party affiliation. We did. When I am a Republican, but a lot of my staff members are not Republicans. Democrats, some are apolitical, there's a whole spectrum of political thinking there. But one of the things that we should not be thinking when we're in the position doing the job is politics. Look, people are going to, I just mentioned this to you right before we spoke, can't make everybody happy. And you hear it from both sides of the aisle, and sometimes the middle aisle, and sometimes they're not even on the aisle. We are doing our jobs apolitically, meaning politics, throw out politics when we're talking about prosecuting cases. I want to remind everybody and you that our duties and responsibilities are set by our state constitution. Advise law enforcement, prosecute cases. doesn't say and prosecute them on a political spectrum. We can't. I represent everybody, Democrats, Republicans, independents, apoliticals. You know, we represent everybody in New Hanover and Pender County in the criminal justice system. So we are looking out for everybody's safety. And that's kind of how that's how I've run my office. And I think it's working.
My other question about, you know, staffing morale is that throughout government, we hear about the struggle to recruit and retain. And that's, you know, maybe sharper in some places than others, in education and in law enforcement. And I feel like in a prosecutor's office, you probably have a much more enticing incentive to go into the private sector as opposed to maybe a public school teacher or a beat cop. There's some real – I mean, just to be candid, there's some real money to be made there.
There's real money to be made in the private sector, and especially if you're very good at litigation. You can make a lot of money out in the private sector. We've got to entice people to stay with us, right? And what for? It's for the betterment of the community. The older attorneys and the mid-level, the 10-year attorneys are there because they love seeking justice on behalf of victims in their community. That's why they're there. They're not there for the paycheck. Yes, eventually if you stay longer, you obviously your pay is going to go up, hopefully, if you know. But it's recruiting these young attorneys going, you've got to be patient with the money. You've got to be here for the right reason. And it's a heart thing. You've got to convince them that what they're doing is for the good of the community. And I'm not saying that private attorneys aren't good for the community. They are. But when you're talking about keeping people, the retention, the recruiting and retention of – we do things for the better good, right? And many people see that. If they stay long enough, you see that. You know, you see that, you know, if you've handled a murder case, that you've got a family there, that you are not representing them, but you're speaking for their loved one who was killed, right? And you're trying to help, you know, every member of the community with safety, whether it's DWIs, whether it's domestic violence. And it's that calling, you know, to do better for our counties and in our community. So
back to your checklist. Yep. That was stabilizing the office. That was obviously pretty publicly a big goal.
It was a big goal. We had to get back. The biggest way that, look, our whole state, and there's, you know, 42 prosecutorial districts, and the people have problems recruiting and retaining. And the goal was, let's bring in good people. Let's find the strengths of the ones that we have here, the strengths of the ones that we're bringing in, and go, can we play to the strengths? People get burned out. People are always going to get burned out, no matter what kind of job they do. And we've got to make sure we take care of our people and say, all right, if you're burning out, is there something else you could be doing within the office? And look, you sit down and say, all right, I want good people first. I can train you to be a prosecutor and a litigator, but I need good people first. And that's what we did. We brought in good people, and they have turned out to be really good prosecutors. So
what else was on your list?
So that one, everybody said, well, you know, what's your philosophy? Because that was the political, what's your philosophy? Well, philosophy didn't really change whether it was a Democrat or an assistant DA under a Democrat, or excuse me, a Republican or an assistant DA under a Democrat. It was to focus on the worst offenders who do the worst crimes. For instance, our violent criminals and our homicides, our domestic violence, and I'll get to that one here in a minute, drug trafficking, death by distribution. We have that new statute, death by distribution, and really it hadn't been tested much. And I have a few prosecutors that were eager to do, you know, to test that that sector. Sex assaults against adults and children, and then our youth violence. And I'll get to that here when we talk about what our future holds. So those were the ones, all right, we're going to come in and focus on these, really try to put those people away. And then obviously everybody was wondering, well, what are you going to do for the regular, you know, the drug possessions and some of these lower level crimes? And look, we did exactly what we've been doing for at least the 15 years, holding people responsible, but trying to find ways to help them better themselves. Drug treatment, mental health courts, veterans treatment court, probationary sentences where we focus on rehab and how to change their pattern of life. And that's what we've been doing.
I don't know if this is the best time, but I do want to ask about Arena's Law and the push more generally to reform the state criminal justice system. And I think some people take a very blanket approach to, you know, tough on crime that loses some of the nuance that you're talking about,
right,
where you can hold someone accountable but also connect right. them to services or imagine a future for them outside after the criminal justice system. Right. I mean, from your point of view as a district attorney, how do you feel about those reform efforts?
I believe that there's good intentions. I'm not saying that a law is perfect, because we have found that it's challenging. When you get into the meats and bones of that law, it's challenging. And one of the things that I was really proud of our General Assembly of doing was looking at how is mental health and our criminal justice system, how do they cross paths, and are we doing enough for mental health? A lot of our cases, and without speaking on pending cases, a lot of our cases deal with the mental health of our defendants, right? Do they do what they're doing because of the mental health, or are they doing, you know, what's happening? And Arenas Law, if you look at the last part of it, is let's form a study that a study of mental health in a criminal justice system. Could we be doing better? And I'm like, thank goodness. I believe every one of us in a prosecutor's office statewide would be, finally, we're going to do that. As to pretrial release, and that's where Arenas Law is really, for us, where it's hitting us is pretrial release and looking at, we've always looked at the record of the defendant, who's really in front of us. We have pretrial release here in New Hanover, but we've always had a prosecutor down in first appearances going, who's in front of us? Is this a violent person? If so, we're going to ask for increased bonds. Or is this somebody that's not a violent person? It's a low-level offense. They're probably not going to get an active sentence. When they get sentenced, do they need to be in our jail, right? If they're in our jail, it's taking up space. It costs money, puts detention officers in danger. But this Arenas Law is forcing us to really look at how are we going to do first appearances and how are we going to handle cases. And for instance, if you look at the law and it talks about how many prior convictions do they have? And if they do, there's a mandatory secured bond. Well, okay, great. If it's a mandatory secured bond and it's so low that a bondsman won't get involved, then, and it's one that it's a low-level offense, are they going to be sitting in jail unnecessarily, even though you don't believe they're going to get an active sentence or it's going to take a while to reach their case? We've got to think of that. It's a little early to go, oh, this is working and not working. It doesn't go in effect until December 1st. But there's also a IVC component, involuntary commitment component of it, that they've pushed off till 26. So that's, thank goodness, because that's allowed us to see, all right, what's in place to, you know, allow us to have IVC proceedings, you know, right, you know, the night they get picked up or something like that. So intentions are probably good. We'll see how the implementation of it is. I'm more excited about the now we're identifying how is mental health and how do we deal with mental health in the criminal justice system? Because we're seeing a lot of that.
Absolutely.
Ask any prosecutor, whether they're Democrats or Republicans, we are all seeing that.
What do you make, and we don't have to go too deep down this rabbit hole, but I am curious what you think of this phenomenon of people putting a lot of burden on magistrates and prosecutors for what a defendant does after they're released. I mean, and certainly there are, you know, you can cherry pick examples where this person seemed very dangerous or very unstable and was released. And we could talk about those all day. But I feel like there are far more where it's someone is arrested on a low-level drug crime and then does something truly reprehensible that the tea leaves didn't seem to indicate that at first appearance. So how do you feel about people kind of putting that blame on
for the
system?
For the last 15 years, we've all had a case where somebody's done something when they've gotten out and we go, oh my goodness, was it my fault that they did it? I can tell you this, we can't control people's behavior. Very, outside of your murderers and maybe your sex assaults and your career criminals, they're getting out of prison and or jail at some point in their life. And who's responsible for how they act? Well, that defendant. Now, we do the best we can with looking at somebody's record, looking at the crime that they've committed in front of us at first appearance, or we're handling and go, all right, what's the appropriate way to handle this thing? Whether it's unsecured or secured bond, whether it's pretrial release or not, or if we're handling it through plea or trial, a lot of that's out of our hands. You've got structured sentencing. I know that they people have talked about, well, somebody had an armed robbery 10 years ago. Well, look at structured sentencing. He couldn't have gotten life without parole. He can't get 20 years for an armed robbery, first-time offender, or very low. People forget about that.
I see that in the comment section all the time. People say, throw the book at them, and they don't realize the book is actually pretty detailed about what exactly you can do.
Very detailed and set by our General Assembly. So people look at us and blame us. That's welcome to retention and recruiting and the stresses of what we do. We all take our job seriously. We do not want somebody in our community to get hurt because of a decision that we make. But you've got to understand that we have to make those decisions every day and sometimes multiple times a day. And we do the best we can based upon the information that we have and the laws that we have.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think, you know, that's a large part of why your predecessor, you know, put some considerable resources into diverting cases to the federal courts where there can be much more lengthier sentences, for example.
Right. So, you know, we've seen lengthy sentences in federal court. We get a lot of drug cases, as you know, and there's some that they have harsher punishments in federal court than they do in state court. So some of those go. Again, it takes the federal government to say, we're going to adopt it. It's got to have federal nexus. Generally, they do, but it's do they want to adopt that? Some of the violent criminals that we couldn't prove a case here, but they've got some conduct that they can get a longer sentence. Yes, that goes federal. But a majority of our cases, super majority of our cases, do not go that way. We have to look at what we have here. Who do we have in front of us based upon the record, based upon what they've done? And we have to make decisions. And those are those tough decisions.
I think people also forget or don't know that you are limited in how much of a person's backstory you can bring into a courtroom.
Correct. I mean, for instance, at a first appearance, we look at the record because we have the record. We have somebody that's their dedicated duty every day to print records for first appearances. And so we look at their record. But again, I've seen people go from 0 to 60, meaning they didn't have anything on their record. They went to and they're now charged with homicide. What do you do with those?
Yeah.
Right? I know what to do with the homicide, but let's say they came in on a misdemeanor larceny, a low level offense that they're not going to get necessarily an active sentence, and you give them probation. How do you know they're not going to kill somebody? We don't.
Yeah.
You know, and we try in some of these sentences early on, probation, juvenile is one, and we looked at what rehabilitative services are out there to change someone's behavior. Sometimes there's not one, right? You've got violence intervention in some of our juveniles. You've got probationary sentences, and you've got to go get CBI, cognitive behavior classes. Maybe you've got go get your GED. There's things in place. That's why we have probationary sentences, but it doesn't necessarily change who that person is in their heart, and we all roll the dice.
All right. Well, we need to take a quick break, but we'll be back in just a moment with more of our interview with District Attorney Jason Smith. I'm Ben Schockman. You're listening to The Newsroom. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Newsroom. I'm Ben Schockman. Thanks for staying with us as we continue our interview with District Attorney Jason Smith. This was definitely on your list for the year 2025,
sure.
And it is something prosecutors now in every county
yes.
have to deal with.
Yes.
And this is e-courts.
E-courts.
So this is for people who somehow missed this, the transition from the good old-fashioned paper system to an online system, and it's not been without speed bumps.
I call them hiccups and speed bumps. I swore in December, we implemented in February. Didn't get a lot of time to think about it. Actually, I'd been thinking about it. However, didn't realize how significant that transition was going to be and how we say efficient because we were used to the efficiency of paper, meaning, for instance, you come into, and I believe a lot of people who are going to read this story have been to our traffic court. Where before I would have a shuck, it's called a shuck. It was a envelope with your citation in it. I could look at it, see what you were charged with, write on it, you know, reduced to improper equipment, or a plea discharged, whatever it was. And that took about a second.
I've watched the, it is like watching like a diner.
Yes.
Where just meals are just flying out of the kitchen.
Yes.
Yeah, it's pretty quick.
And we deal with, there's on average 750 to 1,000 cases every Friday in New Hanover County. And back in the shuck system, it was easier. You know, you can mark it, you could, to continue a case, you just put a date on it and moved on. Thank you, your case has been continued to this. Now with eCourts implementation, that paper's gone. You have to look up the case on the system. That takes time because you've got the circle, as my staff calls it, the circle of death, just rotating to bring the case up. Then in order to do a continuance, you have to click, I don't even know how many times to click for a continuance. It takes a lot longer. It takes a lot more people to staff our traffic court. And we haven't talked about district court. It has really affected district court. Not so much superior court. There were some hiccups there on scanning stuff in, but for the most part, it's district court, including our traffic court.
By the time something gets to superior court, you've whittled away a lot of the paperwork. But in district court, I have heard anecdotally, both from detention center staff and from the courts, that this has created somewhat, or at least at one point, was creating somewhat of a backlog in the jail.
It was creating a backlog, not somewhat. It was creating a backlog and still maybe creating a backlog. When they first implemented eCourts in February, they had to cut our dockets down. We didn't know what we were doing with eCourts. Nobody knew. So you had to cut the dockets down, which when you cut down, let's say on average you have 150 to 200 cases every Monday through Thursday in two different district courts, it's a lot of cases, and you whittle them down to, I believe they capped it at maybe 50 for a couple of months. So we all, not just us, the clerks, the judges, prosecutors, defense attorneys, we all didn't really know what was coming. It was like a freight train that hit us, and we had to understand what was happening. They call it processes, and what's the process of getting this plea done? And it took a while. So guess what? It backs up our jail. It backs up our dockets. We have started to work through that with some effort on everybody's part. We've had to throw more assets at it. That's one of those things that when you talk about stabilizing and reorganizing the office, that was one I did not plan to do was, oh my goodness, I need more people in a district court. I need more people at a traffic court because we can't limit our dockets because our jails will fill up and it will take forever to resolve cases. So we've had to throw more assets at it.
And just for people who don't follow this stuff, you know, where does that budget come from for that staff?
Well, I'm glad you asked. We have state-funded positions. They're state-funded positions. The General Assembly funds those positions, but they only fund a set number. We have eight positions that are on a grant through the endowment through at least the end of 26. That was my goal for 26 is to find funding or secure funding for those eight positions. But the state funds those positions. They're set by, you know, at least the assistant DAs are set by statute. So if you want more than 20 assistant DAs, you got to change the law, right? If you want more legal assistance, you got to go to AOC and say, I need more legal assistance. Right now, they're probably going to say no. So you look to other funding sources, grants through through county commissioners, endowment, governor's crime commission. We look for funding everywhere. If you look historically, DA's offices grab funding from state, local, county, and other funding sources.
And that's a constant process.
That is a constant process.
Yeah. All right. So as far as eCourts go, do you see an ROI down the road where you're like, okay, that was rough, but this is better?
We've already seen an ROI on some of this, and that's for return on investment is what you're referring to. Of course, you know what? You can sit at your desk, and I need to see a judgment from Cumberland County. Well, guess what? I don't have to call Cumberland County to see it now. I can see the actual judgment, meaning the form paper that is signed, or e-paper now, that is signed by the judge seeing the exact judgment. So that's a lot better. I think eventually e-courts will be more efficient. Right now it's just, it's young, there's problems with it. I'm sure that they'll send updates and we'll get updates to it. My people say it's just it's cumbersome. It's too many clicks and too many of this to get to where we really need. And I think time will you know, work in our favor.
I can say as a journalist, it has already started to make our lives a little easier, yeah. Although I missed the drive to Burgo.
Well, you can drive anytime.
I like the clerks at Burgo. They're nice.
Yes.
They're very kind to me yes. when I was a young journalist and didn't know what I was doing.
But it does. It makes it easier. You can get on the portal and look. For us DAs that have more access, I can, again, we can look at, oh, what does that judgment say? Or what does this judgment say? Or I think, it's in time, it will be positive.
So you highlighted a couple of like crime categories right. that you wanted to drill down on, mm-hmm. including youth violence, but there's some other ones.
Right.
Let's talk about that a little bit.
All right. So let me start with our homicides and our crimes, our violent crimes, our crimes that deal with death. And look, one of my goals, and I didn't list it down here because I didn't really know I wanted to do it until I got in, is set a baseline statistically. We've always been, if you've always said, hey, what's your statistics? We'd be like, we don't keep statistics. We got to wait on AOC. We got to wait on maybe the sheriff's office or WPD to tell us, you know. So I'm working on setting a baseline statistics in our office so I can better measure, are my people efficient? Are my people, are they where they need to be, right, in the types of cases? So
are you talking about, sorry, when we say statistics, are we talking about, you know, time from indictment to?
No, not good luck on that one. That one, that's a little bit hard. And with the implementation of e-courts, it has changed everything, right? Trying to get statistics from e-courts is a lot different and maybe easier at times, but maybe harder at times. I don't know. I've got a guy that in our office that works on that, and he's like, some things are, it's weird. It's duplicated here or there, and he's pulling out his hair and saying, I can't get the answer.
I have seen that where I've pulled up cases and weird dates have shown up.
That's it. Yeah, I mean, so when we talk about statistics, number one, how many cases have we brought in and how many cases have we resolved? And in what way did we resolve them? So that's kind of where inner office I want to do. So when we're looking at our homicides, and that's the one I'll give you because it's small enough number that I'm not like, oh, is this accurate or not? But we have resolved 19 first or second degree murders by plea or trial this year. That's a good thing. I want to resolve more than come in, and I believe that we've had less than 19. I don't have that stat because that's one I'm waiting on. But 19 homicides that we've resolved either by plea or trial this year, and then 13 non-traditional types of cases that result in death, meaning involuntary manslaughters, death by distributions. We've four each of those cases. Three felony death by motor vehicles, your drunk drivers resulting in death. These are cases that we've resolved, not how many have come in. And then two misdemeanor death by motor vehicles. So we've resolved 32 death-related cases so far since January, and we're not done with the year. For me, everybody looks at that going, wow, that's pretty good. Again, what's the baseline from last year? I couldn't tell you. I've set now a baseline starting in 2025.
I do want to just really quickly note the death by distribution laws. We've had some reporting in the past on federal death by distribution laws. It's not, you know, it's not a tool in the toolkit of every state level prosecutor. And this is when someone has basically, you know, sold you a narcotic or other illicit drug, and then right. that person dies.
Correct.
And the family often, many, many times, I've heard from families who've said, this person effectively killed my son or daughter. Why are they not being held responsible?
Correct. So that's, we used to, and I handled one of the first ones where we had one of those in Pender years and years ago, where someone had dealt a young man one pill that was a time-lapsed opiate pill, and we didn't have a death by distribution, so we charged second-degree murder hard, ended up doing involuntary manslaughter because that was what was allowed at the time. So now we have a newer statute, this death by distribution, that says if you deal a dangerous substance, most of these are, and it results in the death, then they can be held responsible, and their punishment's X, Y, and Z. It is, yes, we've got the tool of the law there. The proof is where it's hard to prove who gave that person or sold that person the drugs because—
And was this a freebie and did money change hands?
Right.
And
well, that's helped us a little bit. Money doesn't have to change hands as much anymore, but it's still, you have to say this person sold or gave this person the drugs. How do you prove it? Usually through, you know, digital data, eyewitness. Good luck with that. But so we've been successful. I mean, we have resolved four. Four people have pled or have been found guilty of death by distribution since January. That's pretty daggone good for us. But again, it takes a homicide investigation to prove these, because you are really, and you've got to start the night of or the day of that you find that victim of that overdose, because you've got to make sure that there's an autopsy. You got to secure evidence, and it's changing people's thinking about it.
I imagine. I can look this up, but how long has that law been on the books?
A couple of years.
Yeah.
A couple of years.
So trying a case based on a relatively new law, a little bit uncharted territory.
You're right. Luckily, I think four of ours have been by plea, but prepared to try them. And here's what I believe. It's the proof, because we still have a burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. But it's also changing the thinking of a jury, because some people think, and I've had people come up to me and say, "Well, I don't think that the drug dealer should be held responsible. He's got an addiction, and that was, why are you going to hold him? There was a demand there, and he just provided the supply." Well, you've got to change that thinking and go, you know what? Still, somebody's peddling poison for profit, and preying on these people.
Yeah.
Whether they have an addiction or not. It's you got to change the thinking of our jury and in our community.
And I think some of this, I think, is the rationale behind this type of law. But certainly I have seen people change their minds because of the advent of synthetic opioids like carfentanil and fentanyl, where, it only takes one.
It only takes one. It only takes a little bit.
Yeah.
Right.
So I don't want to jump too far ahead of your list, but I do want to get to youth violence, because I know that's a big one for you.
No, I do. That is a huge one for me, and we will jump. So what my – I told you what our duties are by Constitution. Advise law enforcement and prosecute cases. And one that I've carried, and I told you this last year, and I've told people for years, is crime prevention. And where best can we utilize our efforts for crime prevention, and that's youth violence. We have seen an uptick in juvenile crimes involving firearms, whether the possession of, the use of, the theft of firearms. And we've seen an increase this past year. And I've spent most of, if not all of 2025 so far, meeting with our community partners that deal with youth violence issues, whether it's job-related, whether it's education, whether I've spent more time with the school superintendent and the assistant superintendent talking about education. I've talked to a bunch of people about intervention, whether it's substance abuse, whether it's mental health, whether it's job-related, whether it's home life, right? So we are working on, and I'm not yet in this interview give you the details of, but I'm hoping in early part of 2026 that we bring about a new initiative tackling youth violence. And we're going to talk about youth violence, juvenile, so under 18. And some of it's prevention of crime, of behavior that hadn't yet festered. Some of it is behavior that you're starting to go down the wrong road. And then you have some that are already there, but you can't give up on a 17-year-old. You really can't give up on an 18-year-old or a 19-year-old. You're still trying to go change that behavior. You're still young. Change that behavior so you're not, either dead or incarcerated later in your life. So really, we have hit it hard. Somebody estimated 30-plus organizations that I've met with over this year multiple times going, how can we best tackle this? And I feel led to be at the forefront of that, because that's our future.
One of the things I see a lot in cases like this, especially juvenile cases that go into superior court, they go into adult court,
right,
because of the severity of the crime.
Right. Some of them now by mandate.
By mandate, yeah.
16 and 17-year-olds that commit an A through E felony are going automatically to superior court.
Exactly. And you can almost see it on a spectrum based on the age where you see public sympathy slip away.
Mm-hmm.
A 12-year-old does something, even something heinous, something violent. There is a level of, well, something must have happened to him, or where were the parents, or it's a broader cultural critique. But there's mitigating factors that people are building into their comments. And again, this is unscientifically
No, I get it.
Facebook comments. you get older, 16, 17, 18, and certainly once you're a young adult, that sympathy evaporates.
It shouldn't.
And so how do you get people to sort of re-engage? The word empathy troubles some people, but like, how do you get people to, you know, think about this as a person who we could maybe not see incarcerated or in and out of incarceration for the rest of their life?
Well, I keep telling people and you, I think, we've got to change that child's hope and purpose, right? A lot of these kids, I find, have no hope. And the people that are not engaged with the children, and we have a lot of keyboard warriors out there that are not engaged with children or these at-risk children and say, oh, just throw away the key. Do you want somebody to throw away the key on your kid? And I have four kids. You know that. One of them is a 16-year-old. Do I want somebody to throw away the key on him? No. Why would I throw away the key on a 16 and 17-year-old kid? Even a younger adult. We've got to have a sympathy level. Yes, kids make mistakes. And this, I'm a conservative guy. You know that. Kids make mistakes. We all have. You have, I have, keyboard warriors have. If you haven't made a mistake, then please let me talk to you and see how I can prevent kids from making mistakes. They're going to make mistakes. And when kids grow up in at-risk situations or at-risk homes or at-risk neighborhoods or at-risk schools or at-risk whatever, they're going to make mistakes. So we can choose to throw away the key and say, you know, don't worry about them. These keyboard warriors aren't talking to their parents when they're dead, not talking to their parents when, you know, they're incarcerated. Or talking to the victims of their acts when they commit an act and go, have we done everything for this kid that we can do? So I look at it and say, what else can we do as a community for these kids? And I'm not talking about 200,000 people. I'm talking, you know, we have five, I don't know how many kids we have in this, but we're talking about the at-risk kids, you know, 500 maybe or less, maybe 1,000 or less. And if we say, hey, they've committed this crime, and they're 16 or 17, we're just going to give up on them? Would we do it for your kid? Would you want to do it for your kid? Some would say, yeah, throw away the keys, kick them out of the house.
Well,
that's that tough love. Yeah, guess what?
Yeah.
You're not doing them any favors. And you're probably creating a victim down the line. And I talk to victims all the time. What I don't want is this kid to do something more extreme later down the line, and can we have intervened? I have to talk to those people, and I have to prosecute those cases. And I've put away some younger adults for life without parole, and it breaks my heart. I do it because that's my job, but it breaks my heart going, could we have intervened earlier in their lives to change their hope and purpose and change their perspective on life to go, do you really have to do that? And you and I have talked many, many hours up on that.
Maybe this is easier from your position as a conservative. I don't just mean as a politician, mm-hmm. but like that's your philosophy.
Yeah, right.
And there is right now, and this comes in waves. I've seen it many, many times. You've seen it many times. Mm-hmm. A particularly strident pushback on, you know, call it woke, call it coddling, call it whatever you want, but a criminal justice system that is, you know, not hard enough. Or isn't draconian enough, and you know, how do you talk to people? On the one hand, obviously, yes, there are people who have done terrible things, and I think if you laid out the case details in front of, you know, 10 people from across the political spectrum, 9 would probably say, "Oh yeah, that person needs to be separated from society." But how do you get through to the people who are just, who really are hell bent on throwing away the key?
Well, let me tell you, I'm not talking about 30-year-old adults here that have had a lifetime of, you know, chances and chances and chances and chances. I'm talking 15, 16, 17, 18. I mean, go to early 20s, right? I'm talking those people that have not had lives. And I would say to this, am I responsible for their actions in the future? We talked about that. Not necessarily. That doesn't mean I don't think, could I have saved somebody before if I could have saved this kid? It's not a saver mentality, but it weighs on you. You do what I do and you deal with the underworld of society, and it weighs on you going, can I prevent this? Can I prevent this? Can I prevent this? So when somebody says just throw away the key, well, come and I'd invite them to come to court. I'd invite them to come and sit in some of these meetings that I have with victims' families. Or mamas who say, yes, my kid was a bad kid. And those happen a lot where you have a kid who is killed later on that was running with the wrong group. But those are the kids that we're trying to stop from running with the wrong group. And the mamas say to you, if we could have only done this or we could have done that. Come and sit in the room with me on that and say, oh, I don't have any empathy, right? Look to your own kids. Would you want them? And they're going to blame society. They're going to blame parents. Look, I'm not saying, hey, we're not going to blame, you know, parents. We're not going to blame, you know, groups or whatever. What I'm trying to say is we get into with these kids and say, kid, number one, two, and three, you got to change your ways. And they may not listen. They may not. It may be for not. But at least we can say, look, we tried to change the way that they thought. Did he get the best education he could? Did he get the best job training that he could? Did he find something that made him happy that he could do every day that wasn't against the law, right? I mean, you have kids right now that know they're not going to college, that they don't have a skill, right? We're just going to give up on them. And I would say to those people, come and sit in my office and we'll see what I see and then tell me that you don't care then.
I think having sat in the courtroom, yeah. I think that's the thing that helps you, especially, I'll just be candid, when you're looking across maybe an economic or racial divide.
Right.
When you're like, this person's life doesn't look a lot like my life, it's so much easier to disengage
right.
like that. But then right. you see the person and they're in front of you and it's a little tougher not to have any empathy.
Right. Come and sit in my office for a day and see what we see. And tell me then you don't care, because you're going to care.
All right. Well, we need to take one more quick break, but we'll be back in just a moment with more of our interview with District Attorney Jason Smith. I'm Ben Schachman. You're listening to The Newsroom. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Newsroom. I'm Ben Schachman. Thanks for staying with us as we continue our interview with District Attorney Jason Smith.
People ask me, what is the office going to look like and what is criminal justice going to look like without Ben David? And we have been able to rise to the occasion. Our jury trials, we tried 42 jury trials this year. I'd like to get to 46. There's a reason for that. We tried 4-5 last year. I like to beat that number. That's just kind of my pride. But even if we stopped on 42 jury trials, that's a lot of trials. I think there's 52 weeks in a year. 42 jury trials. My people are working hard. If people say, oh, there's a step back, there hadn't been. I believe there's been a step forward. Not anything on Ben. I worked with him for years, but I think we've risen to the occasion. And it hasn't just been me. Really, it's been everybody that's worked in our office. I didn't do it, right? They're doing it. I get to proudly say I just lead them, right? So that is a big one. Our office had a hard year last year. Morale was not very high. Go walk in there this year and see the morale now, and it's changed. People are hungry. Community outreach. I want to briefly talk about this. When we talk about our crime prevention, it's not just inner city youth or youth in general. We did boating safety PSAs. A few of us yesterday filmed a safe storage of firearms PSA yesterday that will run. I don't know when. They'll run it, but we're working on a safe handling of firearms PSA. We continued our community safety talks. We've got some school talks later in December. We go out and talk to whoever will invite us to go talk about what we do. So we still are engaged with our community, and I think it's fun. Somebody has said, is it what you thought it would be? No, but it's more than I thought it would be, but better than I thought it would be.
I can sympathize a little bit in that the community outreach part of my job is fun. I like meeting people.
It's fun.
I like meeting people.
I like educating people on what we do, because that's where you change people's perception of our criminal justice system and what we do. But you go out and you educate them. Hey, this is what we do. I didn't know that's what you did. Did you ever watch TV? You see a little bit of it. It's not like TV, but
I almost feel like people will be more well served in knowing about the criminal justice system if they never watched a single courtroom drama.
That is true. Come to jury duty, and that's where you'll learn.
The number of people who see, like, they find the body. Well, I've joked about this with you before, but it remains true in every show. They find the dead body in the cold open. They crack the case by the 20-minute mark, and they're in the courtroom 40 minutes in.
I would love to do that, but no.
I think most prosecutors would.
Yeah. Let me tell you what we are doing, and we are looking to, and I've been the advocate for this for a long time, so is Judge Corpening and Judge Faison, a drug treatment court in Pender County. It's close. We are working on implementing that. That's going to help that big county up above us. You know, there's 70,000 people, residents there, and they've never had a drug treatment court.
And it's growing fast.
And it's growing real fast. I live in Hempstead.
Yeah, so you know.
Yes, it is growing fast. It took me an hour and a half to get home last night. So
so here's my last question for you is, with the caveat that Wilmington just recently passed its anti-camping ordinance and that most folks I've talked to, yourself included, but also Judge Jay Corbening and other folks, really feel like this is going to take a while. You know, months, maybe a year before we really get a sense of how it's working.
Yes.
But I'm just curious, your initial impressions of what it's starting to look like.
Really, I don't know what it's looking like. I think it is going to take some time to figure out what they pass, will it work? Let me give you what happened. The phone call or the text message I got yesterday was from a young man who works case management for some homeless individuals. And he said, hey, they've got a case in district court. I mean, I get those calls all the time. But there was a case manager, number one. Number two, they found him a rehab facility, not just 30 days or whatever. It's a 6 month to a year rehab facility. I don't even know where it's at. He just said, hey, look, they can't be here. And if they come to court, they're going to get kicked out of the facility. So I said, all right, let's do this. Let's keep them in rehab because that's ultimately where we're trying to solve the root causes of maybe their homelessness or mental health or whatever. Let's keep them in rehab, continue the case for 6 months or however long, you know, however long they think they're going to be in the rehab facility. Let's see where they are then, and then we can resolve the case that time. And it's low level stuff, trespassing, and I think they were sleeping or camping on public property. And it's like, that's a no brainer, right? That's a no brainer. If we can have that dialogue with a bunch of people, we can have a case managers help them get somewhere. Number two, have the dialogue with prosecutors and law enforcement and say, hey, look, they're here at this facility. We're verifying it. We can verify it on a monthly or a weekly basis. And then let's get them the help that they need. Hopefully they get out of our system, right? That's the whole goal is to get people out of our system, not just homeless, everybody, right? I'd love to work myself out of a job. But at least for those two individuals, they are in a facility now. There was communication back and forth from community partners going, can you give us a little bit of grace? Sure we can. You stay in rehab, taking care of the demons that are in your closet, and we'll work on the charges. Now, I don't know how when those charges came about, you know, was it from this ordinance or not? But that's kind of how we need to approach this situation. If they're in fact charged, we're not throwing away the key. Guess where they're going? They're going to rehab. That's how we need to resolve, hopefully, one way to resolve this issue.
I know the critics of the ordinance felt like this is law of the hammer. And that it will take time to disprove their concerns. But you feel like that's not the way it absolutely has to go.
No, it does not. I mean, look, are you using the charges to sort of to dangle the carrot to say, hey, look, you've got these charges. You need to resolve your issues. We do that all the time. We do that all the time with non-homeless cases. You've got that is probation is dangling the carrot. You don't go to prison. You go to probation. You work on you and get you fixed and then successfully complete probation. And then you're out of the criminal justice system without going to prison. Same thing here, right? So we're not locking them up, throwing away the key. What we are is there, if they're committing an offense, which allegedly they were, they haven't been adjudicated of it yet, but allegedly they were, they went to try to fix themselves. All right, let's see how that works.
So. All right. Well, District Attorney Jason Smith, thank you so much for your time today.
Ben, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Well, that's just about all the time we have for this edition of The Newsroom. Thanks to our guest, District Attorney Jason Smith, and WHQR's Program Director, Ken Campbell. Music for today's show was provided by If These Trees Could Talk and Blue Dot Sessions. If you have questions, comments, concerns, or an idea for a future show, you can email us at newsroom@whqr.org. I'm Ben Schachman. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll join us for the next edition of The Newsroom.